Mercy Spirituality Center presents Muffin Talk with Beate.
Kia ora and welcome to Muffin Talk. Muffin Talk has been brought to you by the Mercy Spirituality Center in Epsom since 2014. Please note that this is the last Muffin Talk on behalf of the Mercy Spirituality Center. From August on, we will continue broadcasting Muffin Talk with Beate, but you will hear a new tune and a new promotion. For this last session on behalf of the center, I am playing a repeat of an interview with Pip Nichols, who has been coming to our center every year and has facilitated wonderful retreats. Her July retreat was the last scheduled retreat organized by us in Epsom. Pip Nichols has been a member of the Orbert Baxter Merton Kirk Catholic lay community for 40 years. She has been interested in contemplative spirituality ever since. She is a spiritual companion, a member of the New Zealand Contemplative Network, and in 2015 she graduated from Richard Hoare's Living School in Contemplation and Action. Here goes my interview that was recorded a few years ago.
I understand that you regularly also do 9-month courses with the title Walking the Mystical Path. Can you tell us more about these courses?
These courses came about from a year-long program I offered in Wellington, and 16 people came to the first year, and we ran it over 5 weekends, and at the end of the 5 weekends we had a 5-day retreat. And people from outside of Wellington were wanting to partake in that program and wondering if I would go to Motueka or Hastings or Northland to offer it. But because it was over a year and involved more than 10 days, it just wasn't practical for me to do that. So I decided to turn it into a program that people could do at home. Because my awareness is that there are many people in Aotearoa, New Zealand, who live in far-flung places or in cities like Auckland or Wellington or Christchurch or Dunedin, who are very, very interested in contemplative spirituality. And it's not something within any of the denominations that we get out of parish life necessarily. So this was filling a niche for that.
So you said a 9-month course, but people are staying at home. How does that work?
So I mail out the first, there are 5 arms to the program. The first arm being theology, prayer, compassion, social justice, and I'm just trying to think of the other arm. And there are these 5 arms, and so I develop material on each of them. In between, I have a spiritual companioning session by either Skype or by telephone so that we have a deeper conversation with the person about where they're going with that material. But where is that material supporting them in their life about being a monastic in the marketplace?
You talked about the monastic in the marketplace now. What do you mean with that?
Well, historically, traditionally, from in other cultures in Asia from 5th century BC, but certainly within the Christian wisdom tradition, the monasteries came about from the Desert Mothers and Fathers from the 3rd and 4th century, but particularly in the 6th century with St. Benedict, was the father of monasticism. And that's where folk, and let's face it, it was very predominantly men, who felt a call to a much deeper relationship with their God, went off to the monasteries to do that. And those monasteries flourished throughout Europe, right through to the, really, till about 50 years ago. There's one in New Zealand, particularly at Kaupua, that has about 7 monks, and to be honest, I guess the youngest monk was probably in their mid-50s. So the monastery itself is a place that is less attractive for the average person to go and enter and to make a lifetime commitment. And it's now possible through the likes of people like Evelyn Underhill and very particularly Thomas Merton that have brought monasticism out to those of us who live very much very ordinary lives, very lives with both family and work responsibilities, and it's possible to be a monk in the marketplace.
For those of you who've just tuned in, you're listening to Muffin Talk with Beate. This program is brought to you by the Mercy Spirituality Center in Epsom. If you miss any of our programs, please check out www.planetaudio.org.nz/muffintalk or send me an email at muffintalk840@gmail.com. My visitor today is Pip Nichols. Pip is a spiritual companion and has been facilitating several workshops and retreats in our Mercy Spirituality Center. Pip has a special passion for monasticism in today's world. As she said, monastics in the marketplace. Well, monasticism, Pip, is derived from monos, which means alone, a word that we use in many different terms like monoculture, monochrome, and so on. Isn't it a contradiction to talk about monasticism in the marketplace?
Monasteries became very large. In fact, some of the monasteries had 500 people in them. And very predominantly, monasteries have multiple folk. There are very few people who are called to be true hermits. Very, very few. It's a much healthier thing to be a monastic within a community than it is to be a monastic in one's own home and in a very lonely and separated way.
Hermit are those who live all by themselves, isolated somewhere. Is that right?
They would live in a quite an isolated way. They may be seeing a spiritual companion or an abbot on a very infrequent basis. But one would have to be very mature in their spirituality to be able to do that well. Because human nature is to be in community with others. And naturally, as a result of being a monastic in any way, in any form, is that the compassion within our hearts that's touched by the monastic naturally wants to flow out towards other people and towards nature and towards things. So it's more common, really, for a monastic to be in the marketplace in a way than to be in the monastery.
And what's the origin of monasticism?
The idea behind monasticism, or behind being a contemplative, is to wake up. And there was that wonderful line that Jesus said in Gethsemane the night before he died, when he went there to face his fears about what the morrow was going to bring. And he said to his three mates, "Be present, stay awake." And monastics take that seriously and ponder what being awake means. And what a monastic does is enters the silence and the solitude of their own heart, and within that heart find the peace and the presence of the Christ that's beyond all understanding. I think it's Paul that says that we need to put on the mind of Christ. Well, I don't know how to do that unless one enters the monastery within our heart and finds it there.
So it's the monastery within ourselves.
That's, in my experience, that's the case. An example being that human nature seeks peace, this deep peace. And an example of that at the moment is the proliferation and the popularity of something like the Buddha statue, and that even in the warehouse one can go there and find Buddha statues for $5 or whatever. So what is it about the Buddha statue that touches people? And I can only imagine that the statue is this external image of peace that people are wanting within themselves, and so they buy the statue and put it in their home, hoping that that will, every time they look at it, they will remember that. And I think that that's a beginning practice, and a beautiful beginning practice. And we need to do the work to find that place of peace within.
How do you think you can find that peace within? You said you have to find it, but is there any recommendation or any structure?
All the spiritual traditions, it comes back to being present, to being in the here and the now, and so that our awareness is not scattered towards what happened yesterday or what might happen tomorrow, but that we're able to be present to the moment. And traditionally this has been called meditation in the East and contemplation in the West. And in the Christian tradition these days, there are probably two dominant forms of meditation that people may be familiar with: Christian meditation or centering prayer. And these both came out of monasteries, one in England, one in the States. And it's a very simple way of centering ourselves and bringing us to that presence of the spirit of peace, the divine nature within all.
So this divine nature, what you are explaining, is that divine nature in ourselves also?
Very much so. The human beings, there's that expression that we're spirits having a human journey. That's one way of saying it. Another way is knowing that human nature is both human nature and divine nature. And when those two come together, that's called the Christ. When matter and spirit come together, when the infinite and the finite come together, when the time-bound, which is our human side, and eternity come together. Eternity isn't something in the future. Eternity is something experienced in the here and the now, in the very present moment. And that can come together within the human being. And it takes practice. It's not a belief. It's not something out there that I can believe and wish to happen. We can spend our lifetime talking about prayer, talking about meditation. But until we sit down and do it, it's just a belief. But we can make it a practice so that we too are able to say that the Father and I are one.
In the beginning, you also said the monasteries used to be mainly for religious brothers, and maybe then religious sisters, but it was only for religious. And in, as I understand it, St. Francis de Sales, he, in the 17th century, he said that he wanted to motivate lay people to get the chance to be interested in spirituality, to know something about spirituality, because he thought it was something that it was for everyone and not just for a small part of society.
Mm-hmm. Well, what a prophet he was. Unfortunately, he might have impacted a rather small number of people from where he was, because it must have died out, because when I was growing up, and I was a child of the 50s and 60s, in my parish life, there was no sense of that, of this contemplative spirituality being available for laity. And it was really Thomas Merton who opened up the door of his monastic heart and wrote these extraordinarily wonderful books, following in the footsteps of the great Anglican Evelyn Underhill. And now it's plentiful. So good old St. Francis de Sales for doing that. And today there are some wonderful, wonderful teachers out there who are able to make it very common, very normal, very ordinary, which must have been what the Jesus the Christ was after. But it got lost. It went underground and became very specialized. And people didn't believe it was for them.
Can you give us an example or a little bit of an overview of what Thomas Merton said? Not everybody might have read Thomas Merton's works.
Thomas Merton himself had a revelation, and it's one that people who know him will be familiar with. It happened on the corner of 4th and Walnut Street, and this is when he'd been a monk for about 20 years. And he'd been cloistered and, you know, had spent most of his day in prayer. And so he was feeling kind of a special kind of person. And he went out visiting the doctor and found himself standing on the street and looked at the average American. And within his heart, He recognized he was no different from them, and they were no different from him. And he saw the ordinariness of this vocation to be a monk, and that actually it was for everybody to find this peace within. And we can imagine how he would have been struck by that, because if any of us go to any street in Auckland, say the corner of Street and Queen Street and any other street, we will notice people who are very stressed, very driven. And if we have a sense of peace within ourselves, we would want nothing more than for them to be able to feel some of that too, and to touch that place within themselves too. This side of the grave, there's a great quote from Cynthia Bourgeau, that heaven is not later, it's lighter. And
heaven is not later, but lighter.
But lighter. And this is almost like a koan from the Buddhist tradition. And it wouldn't be for me to explain it. It would be for each of us to realize that fact within ourselves, to understand that God, that to know God, is something that's going to be lighter within ourselves, that we are not browbeaten by this, do this and not that, and a whole code of rights and wrongs, and that only the good get to be in the company of God. It's just not that way when you have this deep relationship with love, a direct relationship with compassion.
When you talk about a relationship and about knowing, that also has depends on the foundation and your experience before. And I think that's why it's similar. It's different for every single person.
I was talking to someone the other day, and their greatest meditation is knitting. And I know other people whose greatest meditation is that too. For some it's art, for some it would be skydiving, for some it's swimming, for some it's gardening, for some it's cooking, for some it's work. But it's also, it's not what we do, it's how we do everything. And it's the level of attention that we bring to our knitting, the level of attention that we bring to our skydiving, and the level of intention. Am I just skydiving so I can have a fantastic experience? Well, whip-de-doo, I'll probably want to do it again if that's the only reason. But if I do my knitting with the intention of deepening my relationship and intimacy with self, and in that relationship, that's where I find my God, and then live the outcome of that relationship, then that's the value for everybody. There's a great, I spoke to a great kaumātua, in Wellington, and asked him what the Māori translation of contemplation is. And he said, noho puku, which is to stay in the belly. So contemplation is not to contemplate our navel, it's actually to rest our awareness and our attention in our belly, and to live from that place.
I think that Māori also see in puku also the center of the feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think of people who prepare food or do knitting or whatsoever, and they do it because they like doing it, they often say, I put all my love in it.
So
that would explain the noho puku.
So not only just the seat of emotions and feeling, but the intuitive feeling, experience, memories, all those sorts of things would become part of feeling, become part of wairua.
Mm-hmm. So the Māori spirituality is helping. It has similar approaches.
I think it does. I mean, I think that New Zealand here is extraordinary. There are so many great monastics, there are so many great kaumātua and kuia who absolutely embody that spirit of peace, that mana of what I might say, the mana of their wairua, the mana of their ancestors, the mana of their God. And there's an opportunity to embody the mana of our God.
Because and there are no monasteries in New Zealand, no outer monasteries, no buildings as monasteries in the Maori world, were they?
Well, I think the marae is the monastery, absolutely, the marae. And, I mean, this is my projection, I'm not suggesting it's theirs, but the marae absolutely is their spiritual home, as is their home, as is their iwi, as is their river and mountain. But, you know, essentially it's for us to find the monastery within our heart and to live from that for others. Absolutely, it's not just to live from that for ourselves, it's only so that we can live from that place for other and for our environment.
I think that what you say about the feeling and the inner experience, if you think of monastic life in the time Middle Ages and before, even in the 5th century, 6th century, at that time the original monasteries might have had the same approach, but then they became more bureaucratized. And it got more professional. And I think once it gets more professional, and it loses some of the spiritual parts that were the foundations of it.
Institutionalization is very difficult, and I really appreciate those who are able to live within an institution and grow from that place. I've spent a year in a monastery myself, and I met a teacher who asked me what I was doing there and suggested that it wasn't necessarily the right place for me. I was only 24 at the time, and I totally agree. I needed to go out and get a life before I could willingly give up the life. I was giving up the life way before I'd even got one. So, and of course, it's not that I have to give up my life right now, but to hold it lightly, as I said before, and to not cling to it as the reality. This material life is absolutely going to drop away at my moment of death. So if I'm clinging to that, I'll be fearful at my moment of death. But rather, if I am clinging to the spirit and the presence within, when I die, that's where my attention will be. And I don't know what happens after that moment, but I'm certainly not going to be clinging on to my material form at that time. Well, I'll be praying that I'm not clinging on to my material form at that time.
At least you've done your preparations and you've done what you could in order not to be stuck with the material side.
I would encourage everyone to consider it.
Yes, it's in the Bible there are also quite a few quotes where people are challenged when they are asked to let go of materials.
Mm-hmm.
They said, and also the kingdom of God is not of this world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's true, and it's not to say we don't have to give it up. I mean, I'm not suggesting that. I think that one needs to really understand the depth within the parables and the stories. We don't have to give it all away. I think it's helpful if we simplify and are not attached and see through it. We all need to live in a home. And, of course, we know how much money that costs in Auckland these days, whether it's rent or that we own it. To not attach our identity, to not identify with it, to watch where we identify with, and to identify with the formless within all form.
Yeah, that's an important point, and I think that it will also help many people understand and cope with changes in their lives more mm-hmm. easily mm-hmm. if they don't identify themselves with a certain belongings. Mm-hmm. If they lose something, then it will be easier if they have the spiritual foundation.
Mm-hmm. Thich Nhat Hanh, the great Vietnamese monk who's close to death himself right now, he said that on the whole, we human beings, we identify with the wave when in actual fact we are the ocean. And we all do that. People used to say to Benedict, what's the role of a monk? And Benedict would say, to fall down and get up again, to fall down and get up again, to fall down and get up again. And so daily, a myriad times a day, I identify with the wave. And if I can once a month or once a year or whatever remember to identify with the ocean, so be it.
These are beautiful words. Thank you very much, Pip, for this, these words and these thoughts. And I think that's a really good foundation for our lives if we consider doing everything consciously. And like what you said earlier, it's not what we are doing, it's how we are doing it. Mm-hmm. And so let us be reminded of how we are doing everything, what if we're talking or reading or whatever. Thank you very much, Pip.
Thank you very much.
As I mentioned at the beginning of this recording, please note that this was the last Muffin Talk on behalf of the Mercy Spirituality Center, and the last Muffin Talk that begins and ends with the song The Circle of Mercy. My thanks go to Sister Jeanette Golia. When I first asked her for permission to use her song in my radio program, she replied to me from the United States saying, "Dear Beate, thank you for your request to use Circle. I would be very pleased if you would use this song as a sort of theme. It seems to have a life of its own and has been used all around the world." From August 2020 on, we will continue broadcasting Muffin Talk with Beate, but you will hear a new tune and new promotion. So please tune in again on Friday mornings at 8:40 a.m. or anytime online at www.planetaudio.org/Muffin Talk. Wishing you all the best and many blessings. Thank you, Beate.
In mercy, we're touched by them and feel their strength and courage. In mercy, we heal the pain of those who are in sorrow. In mercy, we're healed by them and see the face of hope. For the circle of mercy is timeless. It is spirit of life itself, which roots us in faith and lifts us in hope and holds us in God.
Oh.